I had a particularly awesome experience last week for work. I went down, I flew into Philly, and I don't know if you have ever arrived in Philly and just gotten out there. You, like, walk out of the terminal and across a bridge, across the highway, and then down to, like, you know, into, a, like, the baggage claim and everything else is in this, like, separate isolated area.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the rental car pickup shuttles. And I walk down, I've traveled for years, right? I know how to do this. I walk down the stairs, I walk out the door, I wait, look for the shuttle bus. I had checked a bag and completely forgot about it. And, like,
we're recording. Oh, that's great.
And, like, I was 30 seconds away from jumping on a shuttle bus without my suitcase.
Well, the nice thing about Philly is you can walk right back over. It's already faster.
Well, no, because the baggage claim is in the same, like, weird remote spaces.
Well, no, you've got the terminal, then you've got the departures roadway, then you've got the train, then you've got the arrivals building, and then you've got the arrivals roadway, and then parking garage, another roadway, and then the rental cars. But I never take the shuttle buses. I literally just walk through the parking deck and cross the road.
Yeah, so, I mean, I was in the arrivals hall, whatever, and, like, just walked back inside and grabbed my bag. But I seriously was like, I also, like, normally travel light, so, like, just having my shit in a backpack seemed normal. But when I returned the car, I was like, where's the shuttle bus? Because there wasn't one there. The guy's like, oh, it'll come around here in a second. He's like, but if you're flying, blah, 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 you can just walk through the garage. I'm like, really? And he pointed out to me, and I did the same thing. When I walked back, when I went back, I walked through the garage, and it was, he's like, yeah, just don't get hit on that one road between the rental car and the garage where there's no crosswalks or stop signs.
Yeah, because
you'll be fine.
Otherwise, you have to do the grand tour of the airport.
Yeah. The only downside of it was, it was amusing in many ways. I ended up, like, in Terminal D, I think, and, like, had to sort of walk back till I could find an American Airlines kiosk, because I had to check my bag to come home also. But that was also amusing because when I checked my bag, it didn't print the bag tag. It turns out there's a God mode on the kiosks.
But they can just force it?
They can, like, reprint the bag tag or turn off the advertisements or switch it to be, like, auto print bag tags for, like, that's, like, where you scan your boarding pass and it just prints out a baggage tag if you're checking in. Like, there's all sorts of options to it. It's super interesting.
So under what conditions should an agent go in there and turn off the advertisements?
I have no idea, someone was like, you should do that. I was like, yeah, there's a lot of cameras in airports. I don't think that's a good idea.
Can we talk about how much of a shit show PDX is right now?
Sure.
So they've taken out the terminal connector as part of the construction project.
You mean the thing that goes from one side to the other?
Yeah, so you have to exit security if you want to
get
to
the side.
Like it used to be.
Yeah, yeah, like it used to be. And that's going to be, like, the next 2 years, I think. It's going to be gone.
How hard is it just to leave a connector in?
Well, so what they're doing is they're, like, expanding that entire, like, they're going to make it, like, a central security hall at the front. So there's going to be less stuff for people pre-security. So I think it's going to be that general hallway is going to be all the security stuff, and they're going to build that all out to be, like, one massive lobby, a la LaGuardia.
But there's no airlines that are split, are there?
Not right now. Well, I don't think so.
Is Southwest one point? Southwest was on both sides.
Southwest is all now in the new terminal.
There's a new terminal.
Mm-hmm. That's an extension of E.
Which one's E?
E's the United Gates.
Oh,
it's like that,
okay.
That now goes much further down. It's no longer the
where the express gates used to be.
Yeah, yeah. It's no longer the express gates. It's all, like, it's huge. And then actually Alaska is a little split because all the international flights come into D, and if you need to get to a connection on Alaska, you have to go back to C.
But you'd have to go through customs anyway.
Yeah, but you used to be able to use the customs that's right there, right? They'd, like, the bus drops you off, and then you could just walk across the connector.
I don't know. I've never done an international arrival in Portland.
Everyone has to take the bus, too, so it doesn't really matter. Yeah, it's a mess. And then they don't have real TSA pre-check all the time. It's just, like, randomly they'll shut it down.
It's like every other airport.
Yeah, and they'll give you a little sheet of paper so you can leave your shoes on. So it's weird. Anyway.
Good thing you're not traveling much.
I want to. I just can't force myself to do it.
Well, at least you don't have to connect in Portland.
Yeah. I'm tired of being at home. I'm tired of working from home. I'm tired of COVID, basically.
I feel that.
I just want people to get their shit together so things can go back to semi-normal.
You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with host Stephen Seagraves, Fosma Moon, and Seth Miller.
Hello, and welcome to episode 331 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. I'm Stephen Seagraves, joined today by Faz Mahmood and Seth Miller. Gentlemen.
Good evening.
Hello.
I didn't mumble through Faz's name today, so.
Well, Ed will be very happy to hear that, assuming he actually listens.
Yeah. we have some follow-up, first and foremost.
Yes.
We've been corrected.
Shocked to learn that I said something wrong.
Shocked. The pin in the front of the gear does not prevent gear retraction. It disables the steering of the hydraulic. So while the pin is in the aircraft, it can't be steered from the cockpit.
Yeah, basically, this was a reference to something we were talking about with that, like the ground crew pulling the pin out of the nose landing gear. in the last episode, and I said it was for retraction. Turns out it was steering. So you'd notice it well before you got in the air, I guess. That's the good news.
You'd be like, oh.
I guess that's,
I can, in fact, not turn and hold.
I guess that's what lets the tug have control.
Yeah, makes sense.
Never really thought about that.
Either way, a bad thing to leave in the plane before you're departing.
You know, it's funny, like the E-175s, you know, their tugs have, most of the time, a lot of the airlines are using, like, the tugs that go underneath the wheels. Have you seen these?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Certain tugs.
Yeah. Well, it's like they, like, pick up the front wheel, but it's like they're mini tugs.
It's a mini super tug.
Yeah, for the E-175.
Like, a version exists for the 777, and, like, wide bodies, it's called the super tug.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's, like, a Kleenex brand name sort of thing or whatever, but that's how I've always known them.
Yeah, so thought that was funny.
What's interesting about that, random aside, is that it was explained to me at one point that because the nose gear comes off the ground, you don't necessarily need someone on the flight deck. So when they're doing maintenance ferries and stuff across the airport grounds, they don't need a mechanic sitting in, or someone with a pilot license sitting in the flight deck. Was someone explained that to me at one point? I have no idea if it's true or not.
We'll find out next show.
I say we'll find out next show when someone corrects me and I have to announce it to start the show. But that was an interesting. It had something to do with because the nose gear isn't on the ground because it gets picked up by that super tug.
Yeah, interesting. It kind of makes sense.
Yeah, and then there's also the electric sort of tugs. I think British Airways is the main user of these now. It's like a little remote controlled car almost. Like instead of driving a tug, it's this tiny little thing that just drives up and snaps onto the front gear, and then the guy controls it with a remote control.
That's kind of wild.
And, walks next to it and all those things, but you just, use a joystick to drive it instead of actually being in, a super-sized vehicle. And I want to say they're also electric-powered, so it's lower emissions, and it's much smaller, so it's easier to move around and all these other things. It's just, if you ever happen to be, we get to travel again and go to Heathrow and fly on one of their A320 family planes, you'll almost certainly have that happen.
I want to know how much of a charge, do they have to charge it up after every pushback? Or is it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know how big the batteries are. And also, the other thing to remember is, we're talking about things are much smaller, but, airplanes are huge and everything associated with airplanes are huge. So
yeah.
It's not small, I'm sure.
So JetBlue has announced their transatlantic economy product and kind of given some insight into what it's going to be like. And Seth, I think you're pretty stoked about this, being a JetBlue fanatic yourself.
I'm slightly fanatical. Although I got to say, I'm annoyed that they don't fly to Philadelphia from Boston right now.
do they?
They cut back so much; it's really hard. I mean, it's hard with all the airlines, but finding flights to places is fantastic right now. It's interesting. Their A321LR, which is going to be the London flights, and then whatever other transatlantic service they add. It's 24 business class seats, which goes from the front entrance all the way to the wing exits. It's a huge cabin, and then 2,412 economy seats behind that, I think, for a total of 138. It's half the plane, it's the back half of the plane, whatever, as you would expect. A couple of weird quirks to it. The first row of economy is a non-reclining exit row.
Oof.
Because it's got the windows right there. And it's not, but they were smart and are not trying to sell it as an even more space, which is what they call their premium product, or their, whatever, their legroom product, their economy plus, or whatever else you want to call it. So, yeah, the first row of economy is this, weird bulkhead row, hard bulkhead, but not extra legroom, not reclining. It's a weird sort of quirk of the product. Other than that, they've got the self-service pantry option for food. It's going to be at the back of the plane instead of at one of the middle exit doors, because there's no middle exit doors because the plane has so few passengers. So you just have the front doors, the windows, and then the back doors. And then they're doing an interesting thing with the meals. And this is the part where I can't decide if I love it or hate it. They're doing their mint product, domestic U.S. stuff, has always been sort of a tapas style. It used to be there's five things to pick and you five things to choose from and you pick three. I've actually always enjoyed that meal. You sort of get to pick and choose what you want. It's a good amount of food. Occasionally, if there's leftovers, the flight attendants will give you more if you ask, I think. But whatever. It's always been a nice sort of approach to the product. I think it works great in a premium cabin. They're trying to extend that sort of to economy class as well. So now for the transatlantic flights, you get a choice of three mains and then a choice of two of three or two, something like that, sides to go with it. And you're supposed to place your order using the entertainment system. So the touchscreen on the seat back in front of you. You place your order, and then whatever you've selected, the flight attendants bring it out to you as part of the meal service.
Like Virgin America used to be.
So yeah, but it's for everybody. It's not a sort of ad hoc at time, and like it's just, I worry how slow the meal service is going to be.
Yeah,
well, presumably, at least going eastbound, right? I assume they're red-eye flights, so the assumption is that at least half the folks are sleeping.
Right, and so how slow... My concern is it's going to be such a slow meal service, it's going to make sleeping harder, because they're going to be up and back through the aisles multiple times dealing with all that. And, like, what happens when the person sitting next to you didn't use a touchscreen because they weren't paying attention to the multiple announcements that were given that if you want dinner, you have to order through the touchscreen, and they start fighting with the flight attendant, like, well, I want the chicken. And what are the side choices? What? And trying to figure it all out. Right? Like, because it's loud on a plane, except, you know, when it's supposed to be asleep. I worry about that. I think it's a nifty idea. I think for the westbound flights, it'll be great. But I worry about that. They made a weird reference to all morning departures getting breakfast served as the main meal, and for the westbound flights not really having a second meal service. And so if you've got like a 10:30 or whatever departure time, it's 11 o'clock, 11:30 by the time you're in the air ready to eat. If they're serving a breakfast then and then nothing before landing, or something, you know, a small snack before landing that's not a hot meal, I'm worried. And based on experience with other airlines, namely British Airways, that cut back to something similar to that at one point, that I would be ready to gnaw my arm off.
I mean, I vaguely remember someone telling me a long time ago the reason the airlines like to do breakfast is the cheapest meal to serve.
Yeah.
So that's kind of
the same.
Yeah, so it's probably more driven by cost, which I think is stupid. On when you're first entering this market and you want to lure people away from other carriers,
yeah,
I think it's short-sighted.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. The other option on this, and we'll see, you know, again, how it all plays out, is there's some suggesting that the slots that JetBlue got at Heathrow, which is everybody's presuming is where the service is going to go right now, might not be all peak sort of morning arrival departures. There might be an evening slot. And so it might be an evening arrival, early morning departure, where eastbound breakfast and westbound breakfast actually do make sense, right? Like an 8 a.m. departure out of Heathrow, breakfast makes sense. You probably haven't had enough time, you know, time to eat before you go, or even if you did, it's still only 9:30 by the time you're eating in the sky. But if it's, and especially for, you know, an eastbound flight, like I'd say daytime flight eastbound, if someone said to me, like, as long as you finish the meal service by Scotland, who cares? Because you're not trying to sleep on that flight typically.
I'm surprised they're not going to try a daytime.
Well, they might. They might not have a choice because of the slots.
Yeah. I mean, it's a attractive when we've talked about eastbound.
I love them.
The daytime eastbounds. Yeah, it's great. And you know, you get in at 8 o'clock at night and go to bed and wake up ready for the next day. Interesting. I'm not sure I'm a fan of the meal service stuff. I do think it could be a cluster ordering through the – it's just a lot of people, right? If it's 100 and – what did you say it was 112?
112. But only 109 are going to be sold because the last three seats right across from the pantry are flight attendant crew rest. They're sandwiched between the pantry and a lav, so they're going to be super happy about that. And 12A is the last row, you know, port side of business classes of pilot crew rest.
Is it built in? Like, is it just are they taking one of those beds from business?
They just get one of the beds.
Are they really going to, like, they're going to have three on that flight?
They are blocking it as crew rest. I don't know if it was a union negotiation or something else. I'm shocked at that as well. Like, there's the number of circumstances where that flight could go over 8 hours is very, 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 very low.
Like, maybe westbound in the winter? Maybe
if you had to circle for 2 hours, but then you'd be allowed to anyways because
yeah,
you're already in the air. Yeah, it's just not a thing.
Yeah, weird.
I'm pretty sure British Airways doesn't staff them that way. But also, the only other reason I could think of it is like it gives you the cushion of if a pilot gets sick,
you have the extra
pilot. On the layover, you can still come home. You're not canceling one of your own, your one or two daily flights and scrambling to rebook all your passengers and everything else associated with that.
Does anybody do it with just two pilots today?
I think BA does for Boston, New York City area, and DC. I thought that was the case.
Okay. I'd be surprised personally, but at least New York. Boston, I can see. New York, just with the ground delays, you just never freaking know.
Yeah, but those are on the outbound on departure, you got like, it's typically a 6 hour in the air flight, so you got plenty of cushion for that.
Well, either way, you're going to circle. No matter which.
Yeah.
Or at Newark, or at JFK, excuse me.
Most coming in, yeah.
Yeah.
So, Avelo, is that how you say this? I mean, it's pretty bad if I don't know how to pronounce your airline.
Yeah, Avello is right. Little emphasis on the part, but yeah.
Avello. 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 Anyway.
Not Avello. Avello. It's Avello.
Just muddle through it, like you do with my name.
So what they've announced their route map, and they're targeting, what is it, Burbank?
Burbank.
And it looks cool, like, right? Alaska's, and Alaska's already replied or responded in kind.
Everybody's responded.
Yeah.
The launch route, and one of that's going to have one of the most service is Santa Rosa, which is Napa Valley, Charles Schulz Airport. So that's going to go like 5 or 6 times a week. The Mesa in Phoenix, it's the airport on the west side of Phoenix where Lufty has its training facility and where Allegiant flies, is going to be daily. And then there's a whole bunch of other cities that are going to be 2, 3, 4 times a week, like Ogden, Utah, and Kalispell, Montana, I think. And like, it's a whole lot of things like that. A lot of outdoorsy sort of things, right? You could say Ogden or Ogden, I don't even know.
Ogden.
It is Ogden, okay. Is like an alternate to Salt Lake City, sort of, like Mesa is to Phoenix. Alaska Airlines announced a week after Avello did that they're going to add service to Burbank. Alaska already flies like 3/4 of the seats into Santa Rosa, and they'd like to keep that stranglehold. So they're going to add a Burbank flight as well as expanding service to other airports that they already flew to. And then both Southwest and American are increasing Phoenix to Burbank service as a result. I think American goes from like 5 regional jets to 5 mainline planes or 6 mainline planes, like doubling capacity, maybe more. And the Avello plane is 186 seats, I think, 189 seats. It's a full 737-800. Like all economy, lots of seats on board, packed in. So
Burbank's a nice airport, but
yeah,
if the timing doesn't line up, where are all these people going to stand in the terminal?
There's like some seats, sort of.
It's not big, right?
Like, no, if you have right now, like if you have a bunch of regional jets, it's pretty full. You have 2 or 3 regional jets, or you have a Southwest flight or 2. There's not a lot of space in that building.
Yeah.
There's going to be like white planes where they won't even let you go through security until X amount of time before your flight.
Yeah, it's. Well, I think there's not. I don't think anyone's expecting that those Avello flights are going to be full to start. So there's that.
But the thing is, like, as others dump capacity in there, right?
Yeah.
There will be a migration from LAX and some of the other airports when it's easier to go to Burbank. I mean, when I was doing my long term contract at there, I couldn't get into Burbank just because of flights, but I flew out of there every week, right? So if it was easier, I'd use it more often.
I like that they claim that they have 2 terminals. At Burbank, Terminal A and B.
It just means there's 2 security
turn left
points.
Or turn right when you got the security, right?
2 different security checkpoints.
Oh,
I just like that when they push back at Burbank, like you basically are pushing back onto the runway almost. So it's fun. Anyway, yeah, I mean, I think I get what Faz is saying. Like it's tight. So if you've got even a couple of half full 737s, if the flight to line up right, that's gonna be crowded for sure.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. Obviously, there's plenty of people betting against it, but their costs are low, and it's getting planes right now is cheap. So,
who's so are they? I mean, do you think they're going to try and start something kind of like Allegiant does with like vacation packages?
They'd be smart to. I haven't heard them talking about that a ton, but it seems like a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they're kind of primed for that in like wine country or something.
Yeah, and everywhere they go. I mean, right? It sort of doesn't matter where you're going if you can sell those packages, right? You get the commission. Hotel commissions are good money.
Yep, yep. Connect Airlines, which is Porter's copycat, is how's that going?
So there's a company called,
because we all know Porter's back in the air now, right?
Oh wait,
no, that was a joke.
Currently scheduled for June, depending on the border reopening. There's a company called Waltzing Matilda Airlines. It's based up by me in Bedford, Massachusetts, and they're a charter operator. They're in the process of converting their certificate to allow scheduled service, and they want to launch, using that certificate, flights to Billy Bishop in downtown Toronto.
But why?
With Q400s that are serving high-frequency, high-value commuter business travel routes in the Northeast and Upper Midwest. It's literally the Porter Air business model.
So,
but why?
Yeah.
I guess the theory is that Porter was making money on their transporter routes, or that these guys think they can wear and knock Porter off. I don't know. It's a super interesting setup. One of the directors, managing directors, whatever, principals at the company was a consultant at one point that had some experience with like the Toronto Port Authority or something like that. There's some weird little bits of background in there. But the short version is they're copying Porter's route mapping. Like, yeah, we'll do that instead. That's cool. Porter, right? Porter hasn't flown in 14 months, and it'll be 16 if they're lucky by the time they finally restart.
Wow.
But is there space at Billy Bishop to do that, right?
Because apparently there is. The Airport Authority has said that there are slots available that do not go any further because that the no one has applied for them because they don't have the right certificate yet.
But is there terminal space available? And I say that because the two times I've flown out of Billy Bishop, the terminal is a madhouse and there's no place to sit. Like people are sitting on stairs and what have you. And granted, there were thunderstorms. But that's normal in the summer. And you've got this little snow and ice thing in the winter. So it's fine when everything's running perfectly, but everything doesn't run perfectly, at least for half the year.
Almost sounds like London City.
Yeah. London City is a little more efficient, I would say.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, because now you have Air Canada, right? They were doing some of these flights.
Air Canada only flies to Montreal.
I thought they flew. They didn't have any New York flights anymore.
They always. It was always a connection to Montreal.
I don't know.
I just think it's amusing that someone's like, "Oh, hey, look, we could go ahead and do this instead.
This will work."
Someone was clearly in the recycling bin.
Yeah. Well, at this point, the industry seems like a good place to be.
Speaking of recycling bin, LATAM is dumping their A350s.
Yeah. They've been trying for a while though. Like, to be fair.
Even pre COVID?
Yeah, they were selling them to Delta.
And weren't some of the LATAM ones owned by Qatar, or was it the other way around?
Qatar had a lease of four, and then Delta was going to buy them and take the ones that Qatar had operated, which was, you know, no shortage of humor, given their testy relationship. But they, that deal fell apart as COVID hit, and Delta had to pay like $60 million to get out of it. But Delta's kept the future orders that they bought off of LATAM, which is like the next 10, Delta's kept those but deferred them. But yeah, these other, was it 11 or 12 planes that had already been delivered, they just don't fit with the LATAM fleet, right? Like LATAM everywhere else has been a Boeing operator. They got 777s and 787s, and the 350s just don't line up. And it's really an operating efficiency situation. The cost to keep an extra fleet type for a dozen planes, especially when Brazil right now is still struggling with COVID and demand, the borders keep getting closed in South America. It doesn't work.
I actually didn't realize LATAM had 787s.
Yeah, that's from the legacy LATAM side.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Yeah, that's the other thing. So the 350s were from the TAM side and from Brazil side, and the Boeings are from the Chile side, and Chile won pretty much everything.
Wow.
And this merger.
So they're looking to dump them. Is there anyone looking to pick them up besides Delta?
Not even Delta.
And so, I mean, Delta doesn't want them right now. Is there anyone that's like, oh, we could use some long-haul fuel-efficient planes?
I mean,
not right now.
For the right price, someone will pick them up.
Right, so a bunch of them are going back to less. I think four were leased and the rest are owned or vice versa. So that'll be part of the situation. Mm. And the lessors will take them back. But one of the interesting things, there's actually a couple. There's Fly Pop, I think, but they're doing 330s. It's a new UK startup that wants to fly Stansted to secondary cities in India, like Amritsar and Hyderabad, nonstops rather than via Delhi and Mumbai. And then there's another company, but they're taking new NTUs, new white tails that were previously ordered by someone else, and Airbus has them sitting waiting to be delivered, 350s for an all-premium startup something idiocy that has basically no chance to survive. But let me tell you how I really feel.
There's no subtleness about that. Yeah. So Radisson Rewards is splitting? I totally missed this.
Yeah, they're enhancing the program. They actually used that word in the release. Which my response was like, have you guys not actually paid attention to what's happened in the last like 10 years in this industry, 15 years, but whatever. Enhancing the program, they're actually splitting it so there's going to be a North America version and an everywhere else version.
Oh, lovely.
Which
who gets shafted?
I assume everybody.
We'll get Shafted more, the North Americans or the...
They haven't actually released any of the details, just that this is coming and you should be ready. Which is a whole other thing I have issues with. Like, you've got to already know the answers to these things. Like, why are you dragging it out? Tell us what's going to happen and get it over with. Rip the bandit off. Like, dragging it out, like, if you have good news, I sort of get. JetBlue is a master of this with the London service. They've been literally hyping this for 4 years now, I think. And still haven't announced where they're flying or when. So, yay, fine. And they get the news cycle every time, including us talking about it, even if we shouldn't. But you're doing something bad, say it once, get it over with, and move on, because no one wants to have that conversation six times.
Yeah.
And of course, they don't think it's bad, right? Like, they think it's good news, because they're, you know, making things better for us, but they use the magic word enhance, so we know that's not true.
But, I mean, so in the case of JetBlue, I kind of understand why they have to hype it. So there's an awareness that it's coming?
Yeah.
Right? Because otherwise, they're an unknown in that market. And, you know, and who knows, like, how much traction they'll get anyways, because they are the newcomer, right? Most people go by fare. So the question that I have is what they're going to do, how they're going to fare their premium cabin.
There is one reference I've seen shared with me from a beta site of the JetBlue website, saying that there's like the upcharge is about $300. Other than that, that's for the suite at the front of the cabin as opposed to the regular seats. Other than that, I haven't seen anything.
But here's the thing. Well, can they make it work when everyone's going to match them, right? United's dumping 46 seats. Delta has, 48 seats per day?
Oh, yeah. No, it's going to be a huge problem.
Yeah.
So, for you guys, going back to Radisson, are either of you guys, big Radisson? I don't know. I mean, I think the only time I've stayed at a Radisson was when we were in Stockholm, maybe? Somewhere up there. Somewhere in Scandinavia, I think.
It's about the only time I've stayed at a Radisson.
Yeah, their footprint in the... in North America is really low. That was one of the challenges with the new program when it launched. It was mostly Country Inn and Suites, not proper Radissons. So that was a challenge. Yeah, it's not great.
Yeah. So there's the TUI incident with a 737.
Yeah, weight and balance.
Yeah.
Very important.
This is interesting, right? Because it's kind of just like a misinterpretation of some data. Is that how?
We'll call it a cultural challenge. So weight and balance is basically, there's a center of gravity on the plane, and you need the right, with people and bags on board, and everybody has sort of a weight assigned to them, and there's a default weight for bags. They do a bunch of calculations to make sure that the center of gravity on the plane stays between a certain amount of space. Right, you can't go too far forward, you can't go too far back. If it goes outside that sort of window, you run the risk of crashing the plane. Bad. So weight and balance is super important. And smaller aircraft, it's even more significant. But even on 737s and wide bodies and whatever, it all matters. And so there was a software update to the system that calculates the weight and balance. And they do it digitally rather than someone, you know, pulling out an abacus and slide rule. But what happened is the people updating the software... culturally interpret the word miss, M-I-S-S, referring to a young woman, as a child rather than as a single adult. And so they changed the weight value for everybody who had miss as their prefix and loaded the flights with 56 children on board instead of 56 adult women on board. And that's it's like a 30 kilogram or something. It was a significant difference in weight per person. So, and they actually had, the pilots would be like, I don't think we have 55 kids on board. What's going on here? And fixed it once or twice. And they caught it pretty quickly, but there was absolutely planes being dispatched with the wrong numbers because they screwed this up.
So was it TUI specific, or was it the software maker that does the weight and balance software for Boeing?
I believe that software is sort of managed on a per airline basis.
Yeah, I don't think it's a Boeing software, right?
Yeah, I don't think so either.
It's the dispatch software, not the flight deck software. So, the dispatch center sends you your weight report and says you have this much weight, zone A, zone B, zone C, whatever. Go. Put it into the computer and go. And the pilots, generally speaking, caught it. But it was not good.
Wow.
Yeah. Super interesting story.
I didn't realize they go through regular cycles to weigh people.
Is that one of the things? They have a time where they weigh males and say this is the average weight?
Apparently every couple of years they go through a cycle.
They have to update it. And in theory it changes by region and lots of other things as well. But I want to say there was a crash in Charlotte of a Dash 8, a U.S. Airways Express Dash 8, that caused forced the
reweighing, rebalancing, whatever, to happen very quickly, sooner than it was supposed to some years ago. I might be misremembering that, but it was, I think, I know there was a US Airways Express crash in Charlotte, and I think it was in part based on the weight of the passengers being wrong.
Interesting. Fascinating stuff. A lot of data just to get a plane off the ground, right?
And stuff you'd never think of, stuff that just never comes into play. Yeah. As a Beechcraft, Air Midwest Flight 5481, operating as US Airways Express, Beechcraft, going to Greenville, Spartanburg, killed all 21 on board and injured one on the ground. Two unusually heavy bags. It was a weight and balance issue. I'm not sure if they had to change the weight of the people.
What is unusually heavy?
Unclear.
The bags at least get weighed.
Yeah, so although the pilots had totaled the takeoff weight of the aircraft before the flight and determined to be within the limits, the plane was actually overloaded and out of balance due to the use of incorrect FAA-approved passenger weight estimates. When checked, the NTSB found that the actual weight of an average passenger was more than 20 pounds higher than estimated. And checking the actual weight of the baggage retrieved from the crash site and the passengers based on next of kin, it was found that the aircraft was 580 pounds above its maximum allowable takeoff weight, with its center of gravity 5% to the rear of the allowable limit.
Wow.
So I was close, yeah. It really was they were off by 20 pounds for the average passenger weight.
Wow.
And that was in 2003.
I've thought about weight and balance, like, on small planes, you know, when you're on, like, a Cessna or something, like, it really matters. So you take into account, you know, how much each.
I mean, I've been on some of those small passenger planes with, like, the, like, bush plane type stuff. They're like, I've been asked how much I weigh.
Oh, I mean, Cape Air will ask you a check-in how much you weigh, and then they will board you based on your weight and which seat to sit in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Women love that.
Air Canada bailout and refunds. Tell us about this, Seth.
If you bought an Air Canada ticket and had to cancel your trip because of COVID, you might finally get your money back.
They have a form on their website. It doesn't work.
It took long enough.
The Canadian government agreed to a $5.8 billion Canadian dollar scheme of funding to help support the airline. And so they're buying $500 million worth of stock just as a cash infusion. And then there's $1.2 or $1.8 billion loan for refunds. I think it's $1.8 billion priced at 1.2%. It's a super cheap loan to get them to issue all the refunds. And then there's three tranches of other loans that can be drawn at successively increasing rates that total $2.4 billion, $800 million each. That's like 5%, 6%, 7% kind of thing. And also 5 years, 6 years, 7 years in maturity. And so they can tap into that as they need it. And so the conditions, though, are that they have to issue all the refunds using the money that's allocated for that. And they have to take all of the pending A220 orders and the 737 MAXs. But obviously the A220 to keep the Quebecois happy is hardly a surprise, given that everything the government has done around Air Canada has been about making sure that people stay employed in Quebec.
Wow. So are they going to issue refunds then even if you don't contact them? Because you said
you have to fill out a form and do a thing and jump through hoops. And it was like – and they've also already they've already issued them all as credits. So getting that converted is the whole thing.
Wow. Fawz, do you have outstanding tickets?
I do.
Man, you're going to have to give us the inside scoop on how it goes once they get the website working. If
ever. They can't even find my reservation at this point, so I have to call.
Wow. Lovely. There was a CDC middle seat study that basically said middle seats do keep you safer on the airplane. Blocked middle seats, yeah. So having the seat blocked is a good thing.
Yeah, the only thing about that I'm not certain of, and I think it's what the airlines have sort of fought back with, was it apparently didn't account for mask wearing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Like, because everyone, I think the only ones right who are blocking middle seats are Delta right now, which ends at the end of May. Is that
April,
right?
April, I think.
End of April starts May 1.
May 1. And then Alaska blocks middles in their Comfort Plus, which I also think ends May 1. So just interesting because no one else blocks middles. So
you know, segueing a little bit, right? Since salaries are all paid for under the CARES Act, why won't the airlines pull out more planes and add capacity to keep middle seats blocked?
Well, especially with loads where they are. I mean, before we started the show, Seth, you mentioned traffic is up what since February?
50% since February. February 1 to April 1, average daily passenger counts up 50%.
I mean, that's a lot of people. That's a lot of full
planes. Yeah, I mean, we're close to – it's somewhere around 1.4 million passengers a day now. It was – below a million when March started. So it's, but it's still well below the 2.4-ish, 2.3-ish million that it used to be. So it's, there's a little bit of a bounce back there. And the airlines are adding capacity, but also capacity doesn't deliver profits necessarily. Or filled seats, right now, a lot of the capacity is, the seats are filled because tickets are stupidly cheap. In some markets, not all.
I was going to say,
gone up, but they were, there was a lot of discounting going on for a long time.
Oh, I mean, so, you know, my measure is always the Transcons. Transcon prices are stable in the back cabin. In the front cabin, when you're done, it's like a week or two out, you're looking at $2,000.
Yeah.
One way.
I am commuting to Philly or, you know, central South Jersey, so I'm either flying to Philly or to Newark, depending on what I can make work for my schedule. And I had a weird experience last week where the flight down was 100% full, and as a silver at departure, I was second on the upgrade list. Or sorry, American Gold, whatever, bottom tier. And on the return flight, the flight was 60% full, and I was number 8 on the upgrade list. So there are either more elites flying in or more people buying first outright in some scenarios. So, yes, that is certainly happening. I think there's more people buying it outright, and it may just be a pricing situation. But yields are down. I mean, the airlines have said, even as, you know, passenger counts are returning, they're not seeing the revenue come back as quickly as the passenger count. So while we're seeing fares starting to creep up, it hasn't been a sort of pervasive thing, I guess, according to the airlines.
Yeah, but that's because they're bread and butter. They're not flying, which is all the international stuff.
Yeah.
Right, that's where all the profits come from. It doesn't come from domestic F. United, at least, is trying to make up for it in domestic F at this point.
Yeah.
Hey, Bill, jack up the price. You know, that's actually a question I have for you guys. So I noticed that, you know, Seth, I mentioned that Condor looks like they've got on their summer schedule that they're going to start back up on Portland, Frankfurt. But everything I can find, everything I can find on Condor's website says, or even Germany's website says, you can only transit Frankfurt or Munich if you're going to another Schengen country. There's no transit, like international transit. Is that really the case?
I thought there was, but it required testing.
Okay.
Either way, like I said to you earlier, the flights, you know, new flights being added between the U.S. and Europe, or even really any expansion of service, isn't happening until borders start to open up. There was some news today. Macron in France said he thinks that there might be an opportunity to loosen up some of the restrictions for vaccinated passengers. If that happens, expect to see more flights to Paris, right? I mean, actually, Air France announced that they would launch Denver service, assuming the border reopens this summer.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, and Israel has said that they're going to open up to vaccinated travelers sometime later this year, or soon, right? I think it's May or June. So, yeah, we're seeing some traction or some movement there. And then Australia and New Zealand have now launched a quarantine-free bubble of flights.
Yeah, we're recording this on Sunday night, and Monday morning their time, the very first flights have finally landed. Australia was always accepting inbound Kiwis without quarantine, but now New Zealand is accepting inbound Australians as well without requiring the quarantine like they used to.
Wow. Guess good for them, bad for the rest of us. Rub it in.
Yeah. I also find that sort of ironic given like the shit show that is Hong Kong's efforts to establish travel bubbles.
Yeah.
They were an early player in the, yeah, we're going to do this. We're going to do this. It's going to be great. They were talking with Singapore. They were talking with other places, and like, partly it's because they're trying to maintain an absolute zero case count, which in some ways I understand, but it's not entirely practical with borders open at all. It worked in New Zealand because they literally just shut everything down. It worked in Australia because they weren't even letting nationals return home. Like, they had strict limits on capacity of how many people were allowed in on per flight and how many people were allowed with the quarantine rules and everything else. So, like, that worked. Hong Kong has been trying to sort of manage it by saying, yeah, you fly in as whatever you want, but if you have, like, more than X number of people test positive, you get your rights to fly suspended for 2 weeks. And Vistara had a flight that brought 22 people who tested positive on arrival, and 47 had tested positive after 12 days in quarantine.
Oops.
So yeah, that's, I mean, that was the worst one I've heard in a long time. But there's, I think, five different airlines or countries, and then if I remember correctly, there was an emergency order that was just like, shut it down. We're not taking any flights from any of these countries anymore. Not just airlines, but countries were being wholesale cut off because of, I mean, India's spiking locally in terms of case count. Hong Kong's like, yep, yeah, we're just going to stop all of India now. Like, Air India had been blocked. Vistara was now blocked. But the rules about the blocking were by route. And so the airlines were getting around it, like, okay, we'll fly from Delhi. Ooh, the Delhi route got blocked. Better fly from Mumbai. Oh, the Mumbai route got blocked. Bangalore. Yeah, we can get some people in from Bangalore. That'd be cool. Like, they just bring it, like, they were moving it around, and it's a 2-week block. And so by the time they, you know, sorted it, like, the first one was open again. They try again.
Wow.
It's a game of whack-a-mole.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that the bubble's finally opening between Australia and New Zealand when Hong Kong and Singapore had been trying for so much, you know, arguably longer and sooner to get it done.
Yep. One last little topic before we jump to our bonus episode, our bonus content for the Patreon subscribers. So Delta has actually announced that they're going to start flying Portland Seoul as part of the fall schedule.
Well, right now you can announce anything.
Well, yeah, seriously.
Yeah. So this would bring Portland up to four international.
Are they keeping the Tokyo flight?
Keeping Tokyo, Haneda, Amsterdam, London, and Seoul.
All right, so connecting into the Korean Asia network because there are no onward connections from Tokyo.
So, very interesting. It would be three times a week on a 330-200 is what the news is saying. So, we'll see what happens, gentlemen.
Interesting.
Well, I think that's a show. You can join us on the Patreon bonus content to learn about some Airbus news at Finkinverter and a new hotel coming to Miami. To our Patreon subscribers, look forward to that. If you're a listener and would like to support us, you can go to Patreon and support Dots, Lines, and Destinations. You can find us on Twitter at Dots, Lines, more dots, more lines.com. Thanks for listening. Happy travels.
Take care.
See you later.